ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
And a very good afternoon. Selena Green here bringing you The Country Hour today. Thanks so much for your company. In just a moment, I'll be joined by the Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins. She's in South Australia today for a couple of big announcements, or a major announcement this morning, and that is the long-awaited response around the future of the RIC, the Regional Investment Corporation. And we know that many South Australian farmers have applied and taken out these loans in recent years to get through tough times. So what does the future look like for the RIC, and will there be any significant changes as a result of this review and the government's response, which has been handed down today? Plus, if you're buying strawberries at the moment, have you noticed how gigantic they are? Sometimes you've just got a couple filling the punnet. What's going on, and how is strawberry supply looking heading into Christmas?
So we're probably a good couple of weeks behind average the season, but that does mean that the fruit's looking amazing for Christmas.
That's coming up. Now, if you want to join me at any time throughout the program, my talkback number is 1300 160 222, or you can text me on 0467 922 783. But yes, first up today, as I've said, thousands of farmers have taken out Regional Investment Corporation, or RIC, loans to help them through tough times, and many of them here in South Australia. And that's a number that's increased significantly in recent years because of the conditions and drought conditions we've been experiencing. Now, the RIC provides low interest loans to farm businesses to help them become more resilient and respond to drought. So it is essential that the RIC is fit for purpose. An independent review of the RIC was completed well over a year ago, and farming groups have been calling for the government to release its response to that and make improvements to the RIC. And that day has finally come. Around a year and a half after the report and recommendations were handed to the federal government, the Federal Ag Minister, Julie Collins, is in South Australia today, where she's released the government's response. And she joins me on the program now. Minister, thank you very much for your time.
Good afternoon, and to your listeners, Selena.
Well, firstly, why has this response taken so long? The government's had the review and the recommendation since the middle of 2024.
Well, obviously, we've had a federal election in the middle. We've also, importantly, had droughts in Victoria and in South Australia, and we had a drought forum earlier this year in Gawler in South Australia, whereby we had everybody from around the country, including all the agriculture ministers, farmers and others, come and provide us feedback, and we thought that it was important to incorporate that into the response. And I'm pleased to say that the response is out today, where we have responded to the 32 recommendations, the six findings, and whereby we're able to announce a number of things. First of all, there will be a new loan, which is a specific drought hardship loan that will be available to farmers to provide day-to-day costs. So after a couple of years of drought, this will be much needed support for those farmers, and that will be over 5 years and able to borrow up to $250,000. And important, there is a two-year repayment holiday for those farmers in recognition that they have had continuous years of drought. So that will be a new loan product, and we expect that loan product to be up and running in the first half of next year. There'll also be another new loan product that was announced by the Prime Minister around the algal bloom and the marine heat wave, and that will also be available next year. And that will be a similar type of product in terms of up to $250,000, and it will be available to wild catch fishers as well as to marine farmers, so aquaculture as well. And obviously this is in response to what we have seen in terms of the algal bloom. The other thing that's really important that I'm pleased to be able to say to your listeners today is that we have taken a decision to continue the freezing of the concessional rate of the loan, the 5.18% for a further 6 months from February, which is really important, I know, to farmers to be able to provide that certainty. And if you think just a few months ago, we're in a position where the Regional Investment Corporation, known as the RIC, was going to end its ability to make new loans from the 30th of June next year. We've announced that additional $1 billion to go into the Regional Investment Corporation so that it will be able to issue new loans from 1 July. And we're talking about these two new loans in the first half of next year to become available to help people that need it. In terms of our response to those recommendations, we've either agreed or noted all of those recommendations. We're not disagreeing outright with any of them at this point in time. We're just allowing ourselves a bit more room on a couple of them in terms of being able to adapt in the future to what we might need to do with the Regional Investment Corporation going forward. But this provides great confidence to farmers, and it shows that our government is listening and acting when it comes to the feedback that farmers are providing us with.
So if we talk about, firstly, those drought hardship loans, that is a new loan product. So that sounds more like a more of a emergency or short term, you know, someone finding themselves in trouble and needing one of these loans. Is this intended to replace your situations where droughts occur and governments come in and make grant announcements or emergency payments to farmers?
Absolutely not. Under the National Drought Agreement, those types of grants payments are still the purview of state governments. And obviously we have seen state governments both in South Australia and Victoria and in New South Wales actually provide those types of grants and immediate support for farmers impacted by drought. What this is about providing an additional resource and responding to the feedback that we received at the Drought Forum and in relation to the RIC review that was done by Dr. Wendy Craig.
As you mentioned before, the freezing of that that rate at 5.18%, I know one of the most consistent things we've been hearing from farmers is that they want those interest rates reduced to a truly concessional level. I mean, is there any intention to take action to lower the current rate of 5.8? Some would argue that that isn't truly concessional when you compare it against a commercial lender.
Well, it is concessional in terms of commercial lenders when you're talking about business loans, and it would be at an average approximate 2% lower than what people would be able to get it. But we inherited, of course, the way that the interest rate is calculated for the Regional Investment Corporation. What we'll do is, and that's what I was sort of saying about the recommendations, is give ourselves a bit more time to have a look at that. And in the meantime, obviously, we're freezing that.
Sorry, Minister,
I think... to be reassessed.
My apologies, just a technical blip. We just missed you there for just a moment. I've got Julie Collins, the Federal Ag Minister, joining us on the Country Hour today. The government has today handed down its response to the review into the RIC, the Regional Investment Corporation. Talking about certainty of the RIC going forward, is there a guaranteed certainty of the RIC beyond June 30 next year? Is
Absolutely
its lending capacity guaranteed?
Absolutely. And obviously, we've put in another $1 billion in terms of the availability of the RIC to issue those loans. And these loans will be in addition to the existing suite of loans that the Regional Investment Corporation has. So those loans will be able to continue from 1 July. Absolutely. And what this does is provide certainty for farmers and producers that those loans will be there on an ongoing basis from the 1st of July. So that funding is available, that additional $1 billion. And of course, all of the loans are demand driven. So we expect that the funding that we're providing will be significant and substantial.
What about expediting the process? Is there a target for how soon these RIC loan applications should be processed and approved?
Yeah, that was obviously one of the things that was raised in the RIC review by Dr. Craig, was the terms and the time that it took to process loans, particularly as sometimes some of the new products that were added actually increased demand significantly, and the Regional Investment Corporation was unable to process them in an appropriate time, which is why we've done this new particular product this way, to ensure that that support gets to people as quickly as it can that really need it, rather than a more general loan or position that would just increase demand substantially and that money wouldn't get to the people that need it faster. So that's why we've done that. And certainly the Regional Investment Corporation has done substantial work to improve its approval and processing time substantially.
So are you confident going forward that the RIC is fit for purpose for what farmers need out of it?
Well, obviously, we're always in a position where we will look at the Regional Investment Corporation, but we think that this is substantial in terms of these two products that we're adding. We have, of course, announced that we'll also add another product, a third product, in the second half of next year after we've focused on getting these ones out the door, and that will be in terms of climate adaption, so on-farm infrastructure to allow farmers to do more climate adaption on their farm. As climate is changing, we want to make sure that farmers have the ability ability to do that. So there'll be three new products by the end of next year. I'd also say, importantly, Selena, that the Regional Investment Corporation, if farmers are interested in the two new products today, you can go on and register your interest so you can get the regular updates on the details of when those loans will be available. We've got a bit of mechanical, technical work to do and a bit of regulation to make sure that these loans can be available in the first half of next year, so that will keep people up to date.
Three new products. You're broadening the scope of what farmers and fishers can apply for and utilise this for. I know that, as you mentioned, there was an extra $1 billion of funding that went into the RIC. Is there enough in the kitty if you are going to, you know, make these major expansions to what the RIC does and can be utilised for?
As I said, Selena, it is a substantial injection, and we do think that it will be sufficient in terms of the funds available. These are demand-driven products, and we expect that the funding will be sufficient for the demand that will be there.
Minister, we appreciate you making time for the Country Hour today. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, I really appreciate it. And I would also say, obviously, that support in terms of the algal bloom is in addition to the joint funding that we have with the South Australian State Government and the grants that were available in the initial phase of that algal bloom. And around $20 million, I understand, in grants was made available to fishers and to aquaculture providers here in South Australia.
That is the Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins, speaking to me there in South Australia today to hand down the government's response to the review into the RIC, the Regional Investment Corporation. That review was conducted some time ago. The government's had that final report and recommendations for a good year and a half, but that review being handed down today. And as you heard the minister announcing there, some new loan products and some tweaks to the RIC as a result. It is 16 minutes past 12. You are with Selena Green on the Country Hour today. Well, joining me now is John Howard, who is the CEO of the RIC, the Regional Investment Corporation, who is in South Australia alongside the Minister for this announcement today. John, thank you very much for your time on the program. Oh, John, sorry, we're having some technical issues. Can you hear me?
I can. Hi, Selena. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining me and for your patience today. Some certainty for the RIC going forward, particularly beyond next year. Is this something that you expect that farmers will have some relief to hear that this is a guaranteed certainty that the RIC will continue to provide loans?
Oh, absolutely. It's a fantastic news for the whole primary industry sector. It's great news for the RIC, and it's a great endorsement of a lot of work that we've done over the last two or three years to improve how our operations are, and to have an additional three new loan products in addition to the additional funding that's coming forward is great for the sector, great for the RIC, and great for our staff.
Those new loan products, so what can you tell us about how those are going to be applied, who they will be available for, and what capacity there is to provide those new loan products?
Yeah, so there's still, you know, there's announcements that have been made today, firstly with the algae bloom, marine algae bloom loan product. So that'll be in the first half of next year. There's some details that the government has to work through to be able to provide us with the specifics to implement that one. The new news today was the announcement of a drought hardship loan. So in addition to the drought loan that we currently do, those that have been suffering drought periods for in excess of 2 years, there's a new $250,000 loan that'll be incurring interest, but that'll be deferred. The payment of that will be deferred for the first 2 years of that five-year loan product. So that's in recognition of those hard times, helping them manage through that those further extended drought periods. So that one was a good one. Then that'll come out in the first half of next year as well.
So you're feeling pretty confident that those loan products will be available in that time period by middle of next year. They should be ready to go.
Well, definitely from the RIC's side of things, as the minister just announced, there's some regulatory work that they need to that needs to be done to get all the background and the mechanics in place to enable that. But as far as an entity, you know, we're in a place now that we've got capabilities in house that we can deploy those loans, and we'll work with the government to get that done as soon as we can.
I asked the minister there around the processing times. That was something that was raised around having those loan applications processed and finalised. Has there been work into that space already, or what work is planned to expedite those applications?
Absolutely is the answer to that, and that'll be, you know, we'll be working on making sure all the appropriate mechanics and operating elements are in place when the programs actually get launched. But we control all of that internally at the RIC now, and we're in a good spot to be able to manage the demand expectations that we see.
Do you have any concept or idea of what kind of demand that you will be getting out of these new loan products? Obviously, they're new, but do you have any indication of what kind of demand you might be getting for these?
No, but look forward to, you know, working through that over the next period of time. I think it would be considerable because when cash flows are tight and people are going into, you know, the new drought hardship loan will be for those that are in, you know, the eligibility criteria that was announced today was for those that are entering a third year of a drought. So therefore, their cash flows have been constrained for a period of time. Here's a product that helps fund something for a period of time where they don't have to incur the interest expense. So I'm expecting that they'll, for those areas that are going into that third period, that the demand and need for that product would be there, and we're looking forward to supporting that.
John Howard, thank you very much for joining us on the Country Hour today.
Selena, thank you very much.
That's John Howard there, who is the CEO of the RIC, the Regional Investment Corporation. So, yeah, that review handed down today, and you might want to have a bit more of a look through the government's response. We'll hear from the National Farmers Federation on the program tomorrow. They're wanting a bit of time to have a bit of a look through the response, and they'll share their thoughts on that on the program tomorrow. But as you heard, a new drought hardship loan, that's designed to help with short-term operating costs with farmers facing longer-term droughts. So farmers who've been affected by drought for at least 24 months and expected to be impacted for another season can borrow up to $250,000. That loan duration will be for 5 years with interest incurred, but repayments fully deferred for the first 2 years. And then there's also a new stream of RIC loans for what's called slow onset significant ecological events. So like the marine algal bloom that we've been seeing and marine heat waves at the moment. That was something earlier flagged by the government, but this should be available from the first half of next year. So wild catch fishers here in South Australia, aquaculture operators who've been affected by the algae bloom should be able to access those new loans from the middle of next year. If you're someone who has an interest in the RIC, maybe you've applied for a loan in the past, whether successful or unsuccessfully, or you know, you are someone who might be eligible for one of these new loans, what do you think of those? I'm keen to hear your thoughts today. 1300 160222 is my talkback number, or you can text me on 0467 922 783.
And let's get on. Wednesday, join ABC Sport for the third Ashes Test between Australia and England. Hear every ball of the cricket all summer long.
The Ashes.
On your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
23 minutes past 12, you with Selena Green. Well, the system for selling wools largely remain unchanged for the past century. Most of it still tested, then sold in the Open Cry wool auction. So are there ways to modernise this process? Well, one is the online traceability tool Woolclip, which has recently reached a milestone, selling and packing its 1,000,000th bale. Australian Wool Exchange CEO Charlie McAlone says the technology's proven it's trustworthy and efficient for wool growers.
Woolclip is a tool that allows growers, classes and brokers to deliver electronic specifications of their wool specs and to enable that to be traced through the supply chain. So it's a really powerful way of really building efficiencies and building accuracy of how we document the quality of our wool as it goes to market.
This year you've reached a key milestone for AWEX. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're really excited. Just about a month ago, we reached about a million bales that have now been processed through the Woolclip tool, and that's a significant achievement as we move further towards the digitisation of our supply chain in the Australian wool industry. So really pleased about that. We've still got a long way to go. We're under no illusions about that. But to hit that million bales does give us some confidence that we're moving in the right direction.
And that 1 millionth bale was from the southeast of New South Wales.
Yeah, that's right. Down Cooma Way, which is very exciting. And we had some very excited growers, classes, brokers who were involved in that process and chaperoned the bale through its process. And we at AWEX actually took the opportunity to see that bale as it went through the auction process at Eunora as well. Yeah, to trace that and track that milestone. So, yeah, it was a very pleasing moment. As I said, long way to go, but, still nice to see that we're making traction.
And that bale from Jubilaro near Cooma, a property that Charlie Kay runs there. What's the rate of adoption amongst the wool industry more broadly of wool clip versus other means?
Yeah, so obviously you've got the traditional means of doing a written written specification for the the wool quality specifications. Wool clip now comprises, we estimate, approximately 25% of the total wool clip. So, as I said, while that's making some traction, we still have a while to go before we're really at the levels that we would expect and hope for the industry. That obviously helps us to move forward as an industry, helps us to manage the accuracy of data exchange and the efficiency in which that data is travels through to market.
It's been around for some time now. Why do you think that the take up is, I guess, a little on the lower side?
Sure. I mean, with any kind of change to a supply chain or to the way that we operate, that involves, significant shift to the way we do things. It takes time to build confidence in the new tools, the technology. And there are traditional ways of doing business that, become entrenched over time, that it takes some time to wean people off those and make them recognize the opportunities and the advantages of moving to something new and fresh. With the example of wool clip, obviously, this is utilizing technology like your smartphone that is very familiar with most, if not all, wool growers, classes and brokers. So it's trying to, fit into existing technologies and tools that they're familiar with. But, even saying that, there is still takes time to build that confidence and to really, get that partnership approach between classer, broker and grower to entrench the new, better, more efficient process in the system.
That is Charlie McElone there. He's the CEO of Australian Wool Exchange and he was speaking with Josh Becker. It is 27 minutes past 12. It's time to go to the Weather Bureau, find out what's going on with the weather. Daniel Sherwin-Simpson's our forecaster today. Hi, Daniel.
Good afternoon, Selena.
What's going on weather-wise?
Yeah, so look, for most of the state, it is a pretty settled day, although that being said, we have seen some thunderstorms move over the Eyre Peninsula in the morning. Those have now made their way over the York Peninsula and are starting to fire up around the mid-north, sort of around the Clare area at the moment. We haven't seen much in the way of rainfall out of these storms, though. Only Port Lincoln has picked up 0.6 millimetres. Cummins has picked up 0.8, so not a whole lot out of these storms. They're very high up in the atmosphere, and as most people are aware, it's pretty warm and dry out there now, so by the time the raindrops make it down to the surface, they've pretty much all but evaporated. We can expect these storms to move through a little bit of the mid-north into the later parts of the afternoon, possibly getting into the western parts of the Riverland, but still not expecting much in the way of rainfall. The heat's going to stick around as we move into tomorrow, for a lot of places getting even hotter as well ahead of a trough that we're going to see sweep over the state. Temperatures are going to go up a couple of degrees, particularly in central and eastern districts, and we are going to see elevated fire dangers tomorrow. So over the eastern Eyre Peninsula and lower Eyre Peninsula districts at the moment, we are forecasting extreme fire danger. This is probably going to stick around with the current forecast, and as you see the forecasts come out this afternoon, if you're in the West Coast, Mid-North or York Peninsula districts, you might want to have a look at the fire dangers because they could possibly go up a bit, so keep up to date with any info from the BOM and the CFS as well in regards to fire dangers tomorrow. Once we move into the weekend, we are going to see things cool off a little bit, though, with that change moving across. We'll still see it a little bit warmer in the far northeast on Saturday, but it will cool down more broadly across the state on Sunday. Not expecting a huge amount of rainfall with this change. By the time we get to Monday, our cumulative rainfall totals are realistically looking like less than 2 millimetres for pretty much the entire state. Maybe with some of the storms that show up here and there, you might be able to squeeze out 5 millimetres, but it's not looking like a lot for South Australia. Over the next week, realistically, we're in a very dry, settled patch of weather for the next week or so, and we are expecting these warm temperatures to return mid-next week. So we start to see a high move out over the Tasman. That's going to direct northerly flow across Queensland and New South Wales that makes its way into South Australia. It'll be dry, hot air, and those temperatures will persist around in late next week. So the Wednesday and Thursday forecasts for next week are going to look pretty hot, and I imagine the Friday one will too.
Right, thanks, Daniel. You have a great rest of your day.
Cheers.
Daniel Sherwin-Simpson there, forecaster today at the Weather Bureau. Looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales for Friday, partly cloudy in the upper western district with a medium chance of showers in the far east, slight chance elsewhere, chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening. Easterly winds 15 to 25 k's an hour. They'll turn north to northeasterlies early in the morning before turning northeast to southeasterly in the evening. Overnight temperatures between 17 and 24 degrees. During the day, they should reach 33 to 40 degrees. For the lower western district, partly cloudy, medium chance of showers in the far east in the morning and afternoon, but near zero chance of rain elsewhere. Chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the afternoon and early evening. Winds will be northeast to southeasterlies, 15 to 25 k's an hour, turning northwest to southwesterlies, 15 to 20 k's an hour in the middle of the day, before turning northeast to southeasterly in the evening. Overnight temperatures between 15 and 21, and for the lower western district, they should reach into the mid to high 30s during the day. Right now, it's 9 minutes to 1.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Great to have your company on this Thursday and with you right through until 1 o'clock. Coming up very shortly, some more changes to the Bureau of Meteorology's website. If you've seen them, noticed them, let me know what you think of them. 1300 160 222 or the text line is 0467 922 783. Also, speaking of berries, why are they so darn big at the moment and will there be plenty of them coming into Christmas? We'll come back to that after we get some news headlines from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the Premier has described a budget surplus, which is $255 million better than expected, as being the result of an economic situation he has not seen in his lifetime. In the last budget in June, the predicted surplus was $18 million for the last financial year. That's now been updated to $273 million. Sheriffs, Crown solicitors and lawyers in South Australia have voted to join industrial action being taken by prison officers. Dozens of sheriff's officers have unanimously voted to strike for 24 hours. Public Service Association General Secretary Charlotte Watson says she'll meet the Treasurer Tom Koutsantonis this afternoon. And about 670 homes are without power in Tumby Bay, north of Port Lincoln on Eyre Peninsula. The outage was reported at 10 a.m. SA Power Network's crews are travelling to the area and they say the cause is still being investigated. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with the headlines. Well, the Bureau of Meteorology has unveiled some further changes to its controversial new website. The BOM says it had 70 million website visits and more than 400,000 items of community feedback on the website that cost nearly $100 million to build and has been widely criticised since its launch. Speaking on the condition that she was not asked about the cost of the website, senior meteorologist at the BOM, Andrea Peace, walked Warwick Long through the changes.
Yeah, so we have made some changes, as you said, just this week. We've made some changes to the weather map, the radar page, also some other information around forecast or observed temperatures. Just generally tried to make a few changes that we've had some feedback on from the community make some performance improvements and some new features for the community.
Yeah, when you say feedback, a lot of feedback by the looks of it. 400,000 items, is that right?
Well, the last I heard was around 300, but could very well be around 400,000. And, you know, that's fantastic. That is the community speaking and really helping shape the website that they, you know, that they use all the time. So it's great that people are continuing to send in their feedback. And it's helping us prioritize what it is we do next with the website. So we heard a lot of people put in feedback that they were having some trouble with the little indicator where they were on the radar. So now when you log on to the weather map page, which has the radar in it, it was, I think, a black color. Now it's a nice red color, so you can really see very clearly where you are. And another thing that we've done is really tried to make the radar and weather page a bit easier to customize. So now when you click on the information around the layers, what you actually want to display on the weather page, you can actually, on the left-hand side now, we've got all of the weather-related information and then the map settings, which used to be on the left-hand side and now on the right-hand side. People were telling us that they weren't really using those so much. What they wanted right where they are sort of looking on the left-hand side is all their weather information. So they wanted to be able to click the rain, they wanted to be able to click wind, they wanted to be able to click the forecast, and that's where you can also select whether you look at the radar and reflectivity or rain rate. So yeah, we've just really been listening to the community and making those changes to hopefully make it just a little bit easier for them to navigate the new site.
Yeah, and but this is probably some of the items that might have fell through the cracks in that initial change in terms of being around the radar and around rain and some of the, rather than just the initial where you are and what weather you're getting, it's bringing in those elements?
Yeah, I think what it's doing is just allowing the community to be even more vocal about what it is that they want from the Bureau's website. So in the past, you clicked on a radar and you had one view. It was just, you know, you couldn't change anything. And so, yeah, this is really giving people, I guess, that ability to have their say. You know, you could always send us feedback on the old website, but I think people just were so used to it that they didn't really feel the need to, whereas now they've got this ability to actually really contribute to what it looks like. So it's a great opportunity for everybody.
And maybe they liked the old website too, but change, as we've heard, needs to happen. So are more changes on the way?
Absolutely. So some of the changes that I've talked about today were actually to do with feedback that had come in during the beta phase of the new website, so before we actually launched it. And then some of them are in direct feedback to what we've been hearing since the website has launched. So basically every piece of feedback we're getting, it's going into sort of, I guess, a list with themes. The themes that are coming through really strongly are helping us prioritize what we do next. One of the big things that we did do this time around was because we know everyone loves the radar, and some people were having a little bit of challenge kind of finding it if you hadn't put in a particular location. So we now have a button right on the very front page that you can just click on, just right under Discover Your Weather, which you can't miss. And so you can just now click directly from there to the rain and radar without having to put in a location. So that will help, hopefully help people navigate to there. So you can pop in your location once you get to there, and then that'll zoom in on where you are. So yeah, continual improvement. And yeah, we'll keep everyone updated as new changes do occur.
That is Senior Meteorologist from the Bureau of Meteorology, Andrea Peace, and she was there speaking to Warwick Long about some further changes to the Bureau's website that have been unveiled. It is 22 minutes to one. Well, you may have noticed if you are someone buying berries at the supermarket at the moment, they've been looking pretty big this month due to the cooler start to the growing season. I've been buying some gigantic strawberries in my supermarket. Supply is also a little sluggish as some key Australian growing regions have been impacted by the wild weather. Elsie Damo asked Project Manager for Berries Australia, Jen Rowling, how southern strawberries are shaping up this season.
It's actually been a little bit delayed. Like, for instance, it's due to weather, essentially. So the Victorian season, for example, started the season pretty poorly with a lot of rain and even substantial hail events. So that sort of put a delay on production. It's also been quite cold down south, so that always delays the onset of fruit. So the fruit does tend to take a little bit longer to come in. So we're probably a good couple of weeks behind average season, but that does mean that the fruit's looking amazing for Christmas.
So can you just explain for our audience where the larger strawberry producing regions are in Australia, where the states kind of rank?
So Queensland and Victoria are probably the biggest strawberry producers in Australia. So Queensland does more so the winter production season, but we do have summer production out of Stanthorpe, and that's in full swing at the moment. Victoria is also a very big producer, and they do the summer production. So they are the ones, you know, that's couple of weeks behind, but there'll be a lot of fruit coming out of there very shortly. Tasmania is a huge berry producer in general, not as much strawberries, but definitely with blueberries and the raspberries and blackberries. And we also have production over in WA. They're right in the thick of their peak season at the moment in the southern part of the state for strawberries. And South Australia, of course, is also a producer, but a bit smaller than the other states.
As you mentioned, Victoria especially had a not-so-great start to the season. There will be that supply coming through soon. But when you see those dips in production, does the prices for consumers seem to fluctuate much?
It does a little bit, yeah. There will be, you know, at the beginning of the season when there is a lull and there's not much fruit on the market, the price will be up a little bit higher. But then, you know, as volumes pick up, the price will come down. Mm. And then if there's, for example, in Queensland, you know, the peak season for winter production is in August, September, you'll see some really cheap fruit at those sort of times of the year, but because there's just really high volumes. But it all sort of, it ebbs and flows depending on the supply.
So we've been talking about strawberries so far, but for our other Australian berries, how are the seasons looking there?
Again, it's a little delayed down south. So Tasmania and Victoria, for example, are probably a couple of weeks behind as well. So, yeah, blueberries have been delayed. There's a few that are picking at the moment, and they will see consumers will see a little bit of a supply out of New South Wales, but that should, again, pick up in, you know, within a couple of weeks, as will supply of raspberries. So that'll start to pick up as well. But over in WA, they're in peak blueberry season at the moment, and they're apparently got some really beautiful quality fruit.
With Australian consumers, is it still fresh? Fresh is the preferred, or
The majority of the frozen fruit in supermarkets comes out of China or Chile or somewhere else. So there are some really good quality frozen products coming out of Australia. You will pay a little bit more for them just because of the cost of labour and the cost of production is higher in Australia. They're much better quality. Of course, you're paying for the better quality in terms of frozen products. But it's just having a look at your frozen goods and seeing what's Australian grown or where it's actually come from, because, a lot of the, you know, sort of generic general brands will be from China or somewhere else.
And are we growing enough berries in Australia to meet the demand we have in country?
Yeah, we are, actually. And we're also in a great position to be looking at new export markets as well. So we've very much got enough supply for Australian consumers. So, yeah, we're not going anywhere anytime soon. But we are, you know, also, fortunately, being able to look at expanding export-wise. So that's great too, because we've got a beautiful product in Australia.
As Project Manager for Berries Australia, Jen Rowling there, speaking to Elsie Adamo, and head to abc.net.au/rural to read more about this story.
80 years of the Country Hour.
You'd get in trouble for talking at church on a Sunday, but you'd get in more trouble if you were talking during the weather, during the Country Hour, any day of the week. That was always a good childhood memory of ours, and we've learned very quickly that this is an incredibly important part of the day, around that 12:30 every day, and you don't talk when the weather is on.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
Yeah, pretty exciting. We now officially say we are 80 years old and feeling very fresh and frisky and ready for another 80. You're with Selena Green on the South Australian Country Hour today. Well, how much of Australia's water are we comfortable being owned and managed by foreign interests? In total, there's now 4,932 gigalitres owned outside of the country, with another 157 gigalitres being sold to overseas buyers in the past year. Waterfine's Chief Executive Tom Rooney says there needs to be discussions about fair access to water in a tight market and a difficult climate.
Well, in the last 12 months or the last reporting period, now, with this reporting period, we're always a year behind. It takes them about a year to get the reports out. So we're looking at a report that's recently released which actually looks at the position as at June 2024. And it compares that June 2024 to the previous position of June 2023. And what we do see there is that there has been an increase of 157,000 megalitres, which is 150,000 million litres of water, which has flowed to international interests over that last year's reporting period, which is quite a significant quantity of water.
Is there a delineation between what percentage is temporary market versus permanent market? And do these foreign investors or foreign interests favour one market over the other?
This register only looks at permanent market entitlements held by foreign ownership. It does not look at the temporary water markets, temporary water allocations held. It actually looks at the permanent water held. This is the shares of Australians' water resources that are kind of held on a permanent basis now by overseas ownership.
Given that there's been some significant growth in that, and I imagine that will continue to trend upwards, is that a concerning direction for that number to be going?
Well, yes, we're concerned about it. While we applaud the government for its efforts in maintaining and developing this registry, I believe as a nation we do need to ask ourselves, what is the level of foreign participation that aligns with our national interests in relation to our Australian water resources, and how do we ensure that Australian farmers have fair and equitable access to our own precious natural resources?
And that's an access that is being squeezed now from several directions. So it's a difficult time to be so reliant on that access to water.
Yes. Well, look, we've just had, we've got a barrage of reports coming out really over this 2 year period from 24 to 26 ahead of the basin plan review at the end of 2026. We've just had a release of the sustainable yield reports and the MDBA basin outlook, and that paints a fairly sobering picture for a 2050 position in the Murray-Darling Basin. That coupled with the, reliable water supplies, coupled with buybacks, water going to environmental use, plus as well this increased ownership of overseas interests in Australia's national precious water resources is a set of concerning factors, I think, that do need to be looked at. We're not looking at restrictive or protectionist rhetoric. It's more, we're a pretty smart nation, and I think we need to make sure, however, our Australian farmers and regional communities have the same fundamental access to capital and taxation from a water point of view than our international neighbours do when it comes to buying and owning permanent water rights.
That's Waterfine Chief Executive Tom Rooney, and he was speaking there to Timu King. It's 13 minutes to one. Now, I don't know if you're someone who's tried a few of these no and low alcohol wines and what you think of them, but the consumption of these low alcohol wines is growing, and large scale wineries are investing into this category. One of those is Treasury Wine Estates, and it's teamed up with the Australian Wine Research Institute to release an industry first research report that explores the future of these so-called no low wines. Chief Supply and Sustainability Officer at Treasury Wine Estates, Karen Petty, explains the consumer shifts that they're witnessing and what their operation is focusing on.
We've been well aware of the trends that sit around alcohol for some time now around consumption, moderation particularly, and seeing some of our consumers drinking less but better, but also this sort of push towards abstinence and even transitioning out of wines. All these things together have given us reason to really focus on the no and low category and, develop products that are best in class.
Treasury Wine Estates has been producing no and low alcohol wines since 1993. What changes have you witnessed since you first started out producing this style of wines?
We've been on it for a very long time. So, yeah, that's some great numbers there. So, yeah, we've been dating right back into the date you mentioned. But, yeah, the way we've seen it progress over that time is probably a mix of things. So, originally, we sort of did it via traditional type technology. And then you would have seen more recently, we made a major investment in the Barossa Valley around the Nolo facility that has really step changed the quality of products. And I would say the more recent advancement is actually how we've meshed in, for want of a better words, the winemaking craft with the technology. So no one thing works on its own, but putting the two together is very powerful, and the results speak for themselves. The products that we're putting out now are vastly improved from where we started way back when, and I think the future remains bright in terms of where we can take the quality of these products.
You mentioned there the investment in the Barossa Valley facility, which is also using a world-first patent-pending technology. What exactly is the technology aimed at in the winemaking process?
It's all got to do with the aroma of the wine. So, I mean, probably different to some of other beverages that have had alcohol removed, like beer, for example. We have to think very carefully about the kind of the full consumer experience. So that's the way the wine looks, the way the wine smells, and the way the wine tastes. And this particular piece of technology is all around the smell and the aroma capture of the wine process. So we think now with this technology that we've developed in-house, again, we can step change the quality of wine and hopefully delight consumers along the way.
Senior research scientist at the Australian Wine Research Institute, Dr. Wes Pearson, explains some of the challenges producers of low and no alcohol wines face.
The thing about grapes is that they have a lot of sugar, and we've been selecting grapes for hundreds of years, thousands of years even, to grow that are ideally suited to make wine. And by that, meaning create enough sugar so that we can produce the alcohol required to make something a wine. Up to this point, we haven't found anything really that works quite as good as yeast converting the sugar to ethanol as a way to get rid of the sugar. Part of what makes a wine is that process of fermentation. That's why you can't just take grape juice and package it as no alcohol wine, because it's not wine yet, right? It really hasn't gone through that process. So turning into wine really up to this point has been, you know, it's required as a first step in these products. And then we can remove the alcohol once we get to that point. That's where these products start. And depending on how much alcohol you want to remove or the kind of product that you're looking to make at the end, that might dictate which kind of process you might want to employ to remove ethanol. You know, there's traditional distillation, there's vacuum distillation, there's some complex vacuum distillation techniques out there that really, you know, do a really good job of removing all the ethanol from wine. There's some membrane processes that are perhaps better suited to, you know, alcohol adjustments or making mid-strength wines. So there's lots of different options there that can be employed to make a wine, either a mid-strength or low or no alcohol wine.
In regards to varieties that are suited for those no or low alcohol wine products, do they differ from the traditional grape varieties that are currently produced to produce full strength wine?
We're starting to get a bit of experience in trying out different varieties. I think one of the biggest things that we've found so far is that these products, especially if you're trying to make a, what we call, like, you know, a replication product, right? Or a product that's meant to resemble traditional wine. Varieties that are used for sparkling wines or white wines, they tend to be better suited than the red varieties. We haven't quite got, you know, a red variety, like say Shiraz or Cabernet. We haven't been able to quite do that as well as we have been with Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, or Moscato, Prosecco with Glera, the grape that they use to make those wines. Those seem to be better suited to these products. Certainly to this point, that's what we've had the most success with, is with those varieties. And that's probably because, generally speaking, those products are lower in alcohol to begin with. You're removing less from it. And so those wines tend to be, you know, a bit higher in acidity. They're crisper, they're lighter. And so when you take all the alcohol out, that product still does resemble that kind of traditional product a bit more. And so that's where we see where I would say those kind of varieties are typically well suited to this process compared to some of the other varieties that we, the red varieties that we might know. We're also looking at how we can prepare wines in the vineyard, in the winery, before they've been de-alkalized so that they're better suited for the process. For hundreds of years, we've been, you know, working with grapes and trying to optimize them to make the best wines, traditional wines. There's no reason to think that that should be exactly the same process for these de-alkalized wines. So we're working with how can we grow grapes differently that are better suited for the de-alkalization process? What can we do in the winery once the grapes have been picked that will better suit this de-alkalization process? And that will all help those final products.
Treasury Wine Estates Chief Supply and Sustainability Officer Karen Petty says their main focus currently lies on producing high quality, no and low alcohol wine, but there could be export opportunities in the future?
We're doing this mainly domestically at the moment for some of these products. We push in the US with one of our Sauvignon Blanc products, which is going particularly well. We see China paying more and more attention. There's press sort of suggesting that, you know, the younger consumers are looking for lower alcohol alternatives. So we're kind of exploring, but really focusing on getting the product right in our Barossa facility before we sort of push heavier and harder out into different regions. But I think the future is incredibly bright. I think it's a global trend that we're facing into. So if we get this right, it could open all sorts of opportunities for the Australian wine industry.
And given the shift in consumer demand and also the global challenges in the wine industry, what opportunities do you see for Australian wine grape growers in the low and no alcohol category?
I mean, the way we think about it, the best thing we can do for the industry is to really build this category. And Treasury Wine Estates has taken a leadership role in this space just by, you know, pushing some of our products and our brands that are known to consumers. So by creating quality wine at the no and low strength alcohol under brands that are familiar, it only stands to improve, I suppose, the consumption of wine and equally improve the uptake of grapes off the back of that.
What future do you see for the no and low alcohol wines here in Australia, but also globally?
Oh, look, I think it's incredibly bright future. That's why we're investing, we're focusing so much on it. You know, we had a roundtable only last week with not only wine industry players, but broader industry. And that was an important day to get our heads around, like, how do we create this category and what it would mean to build it and develop it? You know, we had state government representation there as well. So our belief, and I think the belief around the table of that roundtable, is this future is only going to grow, and there's a huge amount of opportunity that sits within it.
Karen Petty there, the Chief Supply and Sustainability Officer with Treasury Wine Estates, ending that story by Jessica Schremer.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
Sarah and David from Winky Christmas Trees just wishing the Country Hour a happy 80th birthday.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, finally today, you may have noticed we weren't able to bring you a Dublin market result yesterday. But good news is we do have those numbers today if you were curious about those results. And Brooke Neindorf has them for you. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Selena. Numbers increased marginally as agents offered 7,500 lambs and 2,200 sheep, with just under 1,000 hoggets in the mix. Quality again was extremely mixed, as the majority of the lamb offering are now drying off and generally lacking in freshness. Merino lambs made up a good percentage of the lamb offering, with most in only two-score condition. The usual trade and processor buyers were active, along with specialty butchers and a strong restocker and feeder activity. Prices remained on average either side of firm. Sheep quality was generally fair to good, with prices holding firm on the previous sale. Extremely light young lamb sold from $110 to $188, as light weights range from $170 to $198. Light trade sold from $192 to $236, as trade weights return $240 to $260. Heavyweight sold from $250 to $278, with extreme heavyweights to $300 a head. Light older lamb sold from $128 to $170, as light trades range from $190 to $220. Trade weights return $248 to $257, with heavyweights selling from $260 to $268 a head. Hoggets sold from $154 to $272 a head. Medium weight mutton sold from $124 to $160, with heavyweights returning $196 to $225 a head. The few weathers on offer range from $128 to $165 a head. Meanwhile, in the cattle market, numbers increased this week as agents offered 440 live weight cattle and 184 open auction calves. Quality was hard to find in the generally extremely mixed selection of cattle on offer. However, some local supplementary fed cattle and better bred yearlings found good buyer support. A sizeable consignment of mixed pastoral were also on offer, and the usual trade and processor buyers operated on suitable drafts, with specialty butchers keen to fill their orders. Feeders and restockers provided steady competition throughout the offering. Vealers sold firm, fetching 460 to 502 cents a kilo, as yearlings sold easier, with steers selling from 440 to 460 cents and heifers 420 to 440 cents a kilo. Restocker steers and heifers found good support, as steers sold from 510 to 595 cents, with heifers making 490 to 550 cents a kilo, with both dearer. Feeder steers and heifers were mixed in quality and sold to an easier trend, with steers selling from 440 to 460 cents and heifers 400 to 430 cents a kilo. Heavy steers and heifers also sold easier, as steers ranged from 380 to 420 cents and heifers 360 to 420 cents a kilo. Heavy cows also eased, as they returned 340 to 360 cents, with light cows dearer to range from 330 to 420 cents $0.50 a kilo, and bulls sold from $340 to $420 a kilo. And these numbers have been provided by John Traeger for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Brooke. So those are the Dublin results. That's the good news. Unfortunately, the bad news is we don't have a Mount Compass market report to bring you today. So that's it for me, Selena Green, with you for the Country Hour today. I'll be back tomorrow at noon, and we'll do it all over again. Got plenty coming for you again tomorrow. But if you want to listen back to anything that you've missed throughout the week or any previous Country Hours, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or just head to our website, put South Australian Country Hour into your search engine, and you can find plenty of great reading material, including Elsie's great story about the giant strawberries on abc.net.au/rural. It's coming up to 1 o'clock and time for the news. Have a great afternoon. Catch you tomorrow.
Are you a long-time listener or maybe a first-time caller? The ABC Listen app makes it easy to join the conversation. Download the app for free and use the call text buttons to get in touch with your favourite radio programs live. Download the ABC Listen app today.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.